Welcome to The Geek in Review, the podcast focused on innovative and creative ideas in the legal industry. I'm Marlene Gebauer.
And I'm Greg Lambert. So Marlene, yesterday I had the pleasure of going out to San Antonio for some work stuff. And I think all conferences that are in San Antonio, instead of them being in July when it's 100 degrees, should be this time in February, because it was absolutely gorgeous. My wife and I walked along the Riverwalk, had a good time. So so I'm going to reach out to all the associations and say, you know, forget these summer time things. Let's go to San Antonio in February. That's the best time to be there.
Yeah, well, I had a nice long weekend and finally got out on the bike again. So, you know, did about 20 miles, and that felt really good. And then went over to Topgolf and played some golf yesterday. So, well, we played at Topgolf. I wouldn't say that's really golf, but it's fun.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. Well, it's as expensive as playing golf, isn't it really?
It's true. Without the cool clothes.
Yeah. Oh, no, you can wear the cool clothes.
So. Oh, okay. That's true. It's true, Ken.
So everyone may notice that our voices may sound a little different, usually mine. That's because we usually record in the afternoons. And this episode, we're recording in the morning because our guest this week joins us from the Netherlands.
Yes. So we'd like to welcome Jan Schultz, Chief Data Scientist at iPro, full professor text mining at Maastricht University in the Netherlands. Professor Schultz, welcome to the Geek in Review.
Thank you. Very happy to be here.
Jan, can you give us a little bit of background on your work as a chief data scientist there at iPro? What does that mean these days to be a chief data scientist?
Yeah. Very good question. Well, I'm mostly interested in applying interesting new algorithms in the world of artificial intelligence and data science to typical e-discovery and information governance problems, especially where the bottlenecks are, and then see not only how we can use these algorithms to solve these problems and get the bottlenecks out of the way, but also make sure that we apply the technology in a responsible way. And we make sure it's legally defensible, which is, of course, very, very important in the field of e-discovery. And it's transparent, and that we can explain it to our users, and it's reproducible, and it's stable, and doesn't do all kinds of strange, doesn't have any kind of strange behavior.
Like ChatGPT.
Yeah. No, that's a great example. I'm sure we're going to talk about that later today.
Yeah, I've already thought of some more questions.
Yeah, so it's really the combination of technology and the business process of e-discovery and information governance, and then make sure that the technology is implemented in the proper way, used in the proper way. And I kind of try to oversee that. And so I help people selecting the right algorithms to make sure that whatever scientific research we do is done properly. That's both in scientific aspects of doing it right, but also in ethical aspects to do it right. And then the major dimension that primarily worried about all the time is the legal defensibility. Because I learned the hard way in the past that if it's not legally defensible, you should be very, very careful using technology in legal processes.
Yeah. Like many of our guests, one job just isn't enough for you. So you also work at the university there as the extraordinary chair in text mining, which may be one of the best titles I've ever seen, especially for a professor. So tell us a little bit about your role there and what your responsibilities and focus are.
Yeah, that's we have different types of chairs in the Netherlands, honorary chairs, extraordinary chairs, normal chairs. Now, I've been doing this now for almost 15 years, 15. When I started 15 years ago, I really wanted to do it because in the Netherlands, there were no people that had the skill set that we needed in our company. And in those times, the company was still called Xylab, which I worked with the majority of my life. And so at Xylab, we decided to sponsor a chair to make sure that we can train and educate the students with the skill sets that we needed then to have. So at that moment, I started doing this one day a week, starting with a course in text mining, just finding interesting patterns in text, legal analytics, It's also what it's called in the legal industry. So try to find semantic roles of words, but also relationships. Very quickly, also started doing the information retrieval part of the curriculum.
Yeah.
Search engine building, which is something we always did ourselves at Zion. And last year, it's a little bit more time. Yeah. After iLab merged with iPro, I was no longer operationally responsible. So now I'm also involved in the advanced natural language processing course.
Who are the typical students that you teach? Are they what we would consider an undergrad, or are they law students? What's the typical student?
Yeah, they're master students. I teach at the Department of Advanced Computer Sciences in the Department of Engineering and Sciences. And so these are mathematicians, computer science, which is also my background. So we do a lot of programming, we do a lot of math. And then these students, when they have to do internships or graduation projects, and sometimes they do applied type of projects, which could either be medical or legal or somewhere in industry, or they develop new algorithms. Totally new algorithms. Some of our students, PhD students, ended up at DeepMind. Other students end up at the government. Many of them start their own business. Most of them actually already have a job by the time they get into the master. And only teaching the master.
Mm-hmm.
And their companies paid for their studies, stick around with these companies. Maastricht, geographically, is in the southern part of the Netherlands, very close to Belgium, France, Germany, the Ruhrgebiet in Germany. So there's a lot of industry, manufacturing, and other kind of interesting companies and projects. But most of what we do is medical and legal. And then, of course, the whole part of law enforcement, regulatory oversight. That's where text mining is most applied.
Okay.
How is your research related to, you mentioned information governance. So how is your research related to that? You know, how is that applied in that context?
Well, when I started many years ago, I always believed that, you know, instead of waiting with e-discovery until the house is on fire, and we should go more upstream. You know, and we should clean up our stuff. I wrote a post, I think it was in 2012, which was named The Dark Side of Big Data, warning people about the increase of data and all the stuff we keep. And that, you know, when you run into an e-discovery, that's all used against you. It's a very simple principle in e-discovery. Is if you have a gigabyte of data, you get a bill gigabytes. If you have a terabyte, you get a terabyte bill. It doesn't matter what the data is. If you are allowed, you should, and you have data that you no longer need for knowledge management purposes, you should get rid of it. And in the past, you know, we automatically get rid of us of it because at a certain moment our offices were full, our mountain bills were getting higher. We applied retention policies, and that's all gone because every 18 months the amount of storage we have for the same amount of money doubles. So we have kind of a new law, the new version of Moore's law, that we also see that our legal bill doubles every 18 months. You get more and more data, and it's more complex because it's harder to find what really happened. There's so much noise, you don't know where to start. So for a long time, I was also on the board of AIM, the Association of Information Management, and I've also done a lot with EDRM and the information governance there. And we really try to convince people not to just, you know, be reactive, but be more proactive. And that has always been an uphill battle because, you know, why do you want to solve the problem of your successor? And not a lot of companies were interested in that 10 or 15 years ago, but that has completely changed. These days, everybody understands if you don't have your information governance in order, you're going to pay for it in e-discovery. And let alone that there's a lot of risk in these data sets. There's HR risks, there's intellectual property risks, there's confidentiality violation risk, so privacy risk, GDPR risks, and maybe you don't know how much medical data is floating around in corporates or resumes or stuff that they should long, long, long ago have been rid of. And so we see a major, I finally see this tendency that people are more and more interested in solving the problem more upstream. And it's the same formula, you know. And the good thing is with e-discovery, you have to do it right away. You know, there's no room for errors. But the information governance, there's, you know, the requirements, equality are not as high. And you, if there's something goes wrong, you can fix it. You're also able to use more interesting AI techniques in the information governance part than you can use in e-discovery. E-discovery, you have to be very careful. Whatever you use that is not going to be used against you, have to be very careful that, you know, the technology is understood by the other party. You don't want to have an e-discovery or an e-discovery. And then, so there's a little bit more room for flexibility in information governance. So I think, you know, together and, you know, yeah, smart companies clean up the house.
Yeah. Many firms now have, you know, an information governance policy, but, you know, yet it is a struggle because that age old, you know, I want to keep it because I might need it sort of theory is still with us. But, you know, it certainly has come a long way since, you know, you started talking about it in 2012.
Yeah.
So
yeah. Really interesting. What you're saying now is I talked to you. You may know Jason Baron. He was the former director of litigation support at the White House and the National Archives. And he told me once that from all the data that they got at the National Archives, there was probably like 1% of what these departments had. And they felt it was really, really important to keep. I think they threw away another 95% of that because they thought it was completely irrelevant. So yeah, we do believe that when something is, there's more data that's important than at the end of the day, it really is.
Yeah. Well, maybe we'll call it Schultz's law that your data risk doubles every 18 months now.
Thank you, right. Yeah, make me famous. Yeah.
So, Jan, you've written about how AI can be used to improve the due diligence process for M&A deals. So, you know, there's a lot of AI tools out there for M&A due diligence right now. And I would say that they can work well if you invest the time and the effort in them. And that, at least in law firms, there's sometimes a struggle with that because... You know, people, you know, we mentioned chat AI before, and people are kind of expecting it to work like that. Like, you know, you just say something and it does what you want. And that isn't always the case with at least some of the tools that are on the market. So how do you see AI tools sort of improving the due diligence process for attorneys?
Yeah. Well, M&A and due diligence next to FRE discovery is the most successful market of AI tools in the legal industry.
Yeah, because it's large amounts of data that you have to crunch, right?
There's no way around AI. You know, some people call it, well, they say it's not AI, it's more like information retrieval and search. I believe it's more like the sorting process. So you sort the data along the dimensions that you're interested in, and then by sorting it and analyzing it and enriching it, you can quicker find answers to typical questions you have. Now, if you go back to M&A and the due diligence, there's two types of due diligence. There's the vendor due diligence, where you want to sell your company, and then there's the due diligence where you want to buy a company. And they're very different in nature. In vendor due diligence, corporates and law firms have access to all the data, also to the original data, sometimes emails where it originates from, and memos and drafts and that can really help you to get an audit of what's going on. Also, you have the data yourself physically, so you can search it, enrich it, and do all the, you know, all the great stuff you can do with it. Find patterns for change of control. You know, a typical list of due diligence risks is pretty limited. And I think 80 or 90% of those risks you can very quickly find. It's change of control, liability, jurisdictions, different versions of different templates. The part what's harder is when you want to buy a company. The other party is often very reluctant giving you the data electronically. So you have to work in one of these M&A environments where you can only page up and page down. You don't have access to the text. They don't want you to text mine it. So you're limited in what you can do. There's different parties on the market that have different solutions. But what we see is kind of a tendency from corporates and also law firms where they say, well, we just want to have a copy of the data room. And then we upload it in tools, typical similar tools like e-discovery tools. And then we're going to look for certain patterns and certain risks. Now, you're looking for very context-sensitive patterns. What I've seen is that many of the parties that use these tools, they still use keyword search or regular expressions or basic search. But if you want to have like a change of control in the context of more than 49% of change of ownership with a certain amount to it, and you have these really complex relations that you're looking for, then these tools are pretty limited. But they get better and better, and especially with the development of deep learning and the transformers that are also used in ChatGPT, they are much better in finding contextual relationships. So that's getting better and better and better. On the other hand, I strongly believe in the combination of machines and humans, especially for these legal, but also for medical applications. And like I said, you can probably find 80% of all the problems in the due diligence by using technology. But then by judging it, whether it's really a problem, that's where you need, in many cases, you need a human to determine the context. So it's this combination of human and machine, where the machine does the heavy lifting and the human decides whether something is relevant or not, whether it's a false positive or a false negative. That's what really works. I also believe that's the way forward in M&A, because I really don't believe, you know, in juniors with binders and yellow markers going to data room binders. Yeah, you're laughing, but you don't want to know how many law firms, especially in Europe, you know, are still doing that. And I don't know. You know, maybe great for your billable hours, but and there's also law firms that went bust because they missed something.
Right. With the change in structure, because you talked about how a lot of times we're still using keywords to try and identify the sections that are relevant.
Yep.
So if you have people that are well established in doing things the traditional way, how do you guide them through to say, here's the difference on how you apply this type of learning to the project, rather than looking for those key phrases? We talk more, you look at the semantics of the saying and so the context of it.
Yeah.
How do you approach people like that to kind of get them out of the old routine and into the new?
Yeah. Well, the best way is to show them that by examples that it works. What we typically do is we have like a couple of, we have a data set when we know what's in the data set, and then we kind of challenge them. Okay, why don't you review this data set the old fashioned way? And let's see what you come up with, how long it takes. And then we do it with technology. And then typically we find 2 to 3 times more relevant information in a fraction of the time. And then it's up to them, you know, they have to make a decision. Do you want to deliver a low quality service at a very high price, which at the end of the day is probably not going to be very competitive? Or are you going to offer a high quality service for which you can probably also charge a higher price? Because a lawyer empowered with technology can do more work than a lawyer without technology. You can charge more per hour for a technology empowered lawyer than for a lawyer in the basement with a binder and a marker. The amount of errors is astonishing. Computers may not be perfect, but they're consistent in their errors and in their performance. And typical computer programs are around 70-80% precision and recall, and the new ones using deep learning are around 90% precision and recall. Mm-hmm. Now, good humans are, really good humans are at 85%. Average humans are, you know, maybe 70. But those average humans on Monday morning or Friday afternoon can be 30% in quality. Yep. And you don't know, because we humans are even inconsistent in us being inconsistent. So if you want to fix errors, it's very hard. And with technology, there's a great book you've probably read, it from Paul Doherty, Human Plus Machine. Mm-hmm. And they show a lot of examples where the computer does like 80%, and then the human is also 80%. But if they work together, you get more than 95-97%. And that's what we see in medical application, radiology, but also in legal applications. And, you know, humans are cognitively not suited to analyze the details of 20 binders, you know, with a marker. Computers are really good at that stuff. But humans are better in stuff that computers are not very good at. You know, computers you know, very irrational, miscontext, miscommon sense. You know, they cannot reflect, can simulate, they reflect. But by the combination, you get the best solution. And the other thing is, and this is very important, if you use AI in legal applications, the users need to understand and feel that they control the AI. So it's like a car. You know, if you brake, you want to go slower. You don't want to go faster. And if you hit the gas, you want to go faster. So you should give these lawyers, you should show them how the AI can be steered and can control it. And one of the most successful workshops we had, we started doing that like 7 or 8 years ago. We took the Enrol data set. We let, in the Enrol, there's a lot of travel itineraries. So we let the user search for the travel itineraries, and we knew there were about, you know, 80 travel itineraries in there, and a 500,000 emails. And then typically people would either find 5,000 emails, including a lot of weekend offers from Las Vegas, or they would only find like 20 of the relevant ones. And we would let them play around with Boolean search and fuzzy search and everything, and, you know, quorum search and nested Booleans and brackets. And then we showed them how to do it with assisted review, active learning. And then within 20 minutes, they popped up these 60 documents, and they only had to look at like 120 or 200 documents in order to find them. You know, 95% recall at a minimum effort. And then they noticed that if they were getting like offers for a weekend in Vegas, that if they told the computer, this is not what I'm looking for, that in the next iteration, those were gone. And if there was another one that they missed, they said, well, I also want to have these and these and these. They would see that these would actually pop up in one of the final training cycles. So hey, you're probably familiar with that yourself when you're using this machine learning. And then you have the feeling that you control it. And then if you can explain it and it's transparent, and the system behaves similar in different use cases, that's when you can create trust. And that's the most important, trust. And then people will start using it.
Yeah,
exactly.
Jan, we would be remiss if we didn't have somebody in from Europe and not at least talk a little bit about GDPR. GDPR is a constant issue both there in Europe and for anyone that's doing business either in Europe or with Europeans. In what ways are you seeing AI help companies remain GDPR compliant? And I'm wondering also on the flip side of that, are there any risks that may be involved that we're not thinking about when it comes to using AI?
Yeah, well, there's different aspects of the GDPR. First of all, part of it is that you need to have a reason why you store certain data. If you have that reason and you explain what you're doing and you can explain how you're doing it, you can do pretty much everything you want. It's only if you have no reason, you cannot build data sets that contain personal data or worst case medical data, individuals. And there's different gradations. And it's not only the GDPR, I think it's also the California privacy laws. It's the Massachusetts, Washington State. We see these rules popping up everywhere. And I think they even have privacy rules in China. Well, maybe they use them for different reasons. But all these rules help us to control data. Now, the problem is that these GDPR rules are often contradicting United States e-discovery required. And then the only way to solve that is by using technology. One of the things you can do using text mining technology is to identify whether a word is an individual name or a company name or a location, you know, a phone number or an address or whatever, bank account number. And then you can do two things. You can either redact them, but you can also pseudonymize them. And that's what we see a lot in e-discovery between Germany and France, for instance, and the United States. Whenever there's like a patent dispute or another reason for large-scale e-discovery, that in Europe, the data is not redacted or anonymized, but it's pseudonymized. And then for each of the names, we automatically assign, you know, a number. And then the data is transferred to the United States according to the requirements of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure and whatever parties negotiate. And then whenever, if they find that they really need to know the name of an individual because somebody did something, or they need to, you know, have the name of that custodian, then it can be obtained from the pseudonymization list. And that work, reviewing 1 million documents is hard, but redacting 1 million documents is impossible. Human beings are simply not completely suited for that type of work. But that's great stuff. That's great work that you can do by using computers. And that's exactly what, that's one of the the killer applications of text mining in the legal space in Europe is redaction and pseudonymization of personal data.
So I wanted to pose a question based on a couple of things that you said earlier. You did mention that, you know, you're a strong believer in humans working with new technology, yeah, that the technology isn't going to replace lawyers. You know, and then you also mentioned that, you know, in order to be successful, they have to feel like they're controlling it. And that resonated with me as well, because, you know, I look at things like the chat AI type of technology where it really does, you know, the problems with it aside, I mean, if you give it a control group of documents, it'll write a base memo. It'll do very, you know, it'll do sort of the basic things to sort of get you started. And while, of course, you do need oversight for that, I guess there's also the argument that you might need fewer people to do that because the work is generated to an extent. And that, I think, leads to maybe some of the nervousness, I guess, that we're seeing in addition to the problems, you know, sort of the made up things, stuff like that. But how would you respond to these concerns that increased use of AI in the legal field, you know, could lead to job loss for lawyers and other legal professionals that were the ones who were actually doing some of that base level work before?
Yeah, no, that's a very good question. I believe that the industry with the most burnouts is the legal industry. So I think there will always be more than enough work. And you also see that there's a whole new generation of lawyers now, young people coming from universities that study law because they are interested in providing strategic legal advice to their client. They didn't go to Harvard or, you know, Stanford Law School in order to be in the basement with a binder and a marker, and just so to say it. And so we see that I've actually been invited by law firms to help them with their recruitment. So they asked me to come to their law firm, show how their law firm was using technology and, you know, talk a little bit about AI and how great it is and how we control it and how we measure the quality and how you incorporate it in the legal processes. And that's what they use to show, you know, recruits that, okay, if you work with us, you're going to do really interesting work. We have outsourced all the boring work to technology. And I don't know how it is in the US job market, but here in Europe, it's very hard for law firms to find reading lawyers. And they need this technology. You see that not only for the recruitment, but also for, at the end of the day, they will make errors. If they are not going to jump on this technology bandwagon, the big four will. There's a whole group of people ready to start competing with law firms. The only reason why they don't yet is because the ABA or the European Bar Associations have forbidden them, but they're ready to go. You know, there's in the Netherlands, KPMG has more lawyers than the larger law firms have, and they're ready and they embrace technology. So if you provide a service that's too slow, too expensive, and doesn't have the quality it could have, at the end of the day, that's not a competitive service. And I think that most law firms understand. But they should also understand that they should embrace maybe different methods for billing. And like I said, a lawyer empowered by technology, you could charge more per hour than a lawyer who's not empowered by. And often they're afraid to do that. And you can also have a subscription model, or you can have a fixed price. And the really interesting thing that I noticed is that law firms that do class act, they all use technology from the beginning to the end because they have to have efficiency. Yeah, we can talk about it for hours. But yep. At the end of the day, you have to have a competitive service.
Yeah, Jan, when you were talking about charging more for the attorney plus technology, that's not a novel concept for law firms, because we have also charged more for, maybe some of our listeners are going to cringe when I say this, but lawyers using Westlaw cost more than lawyers, you know, at least per hour cost more. Sure. And because we would charge back for using basically that technology. It's not a foreign concept to the legal industry of charging for this? And it may be one of the ways that, some of the firms, I think, that are knowing that they need to get into it but not sure how they can afford it, maybe this is one of those options. I don't know if it'll work, but like I said, it's not new.
Well, the way how I address this is that I typically show them, there's a difference between revenue and profit. Revenue is vanity, profit is sanity. It's an old saying. And law firms really go for the revenue. Mm-hmm. But if you have like 100 people doing a legal review and you pay them like $50 an hour, you charge $100 an hour, then you can do the math and you see that if you use machine learning and data scientists and AI and more expensive lawyers, at the end of the day, you make more money.
Right.
And you have less risk, because there's a huge risk that humans are cognitively not suited for a lot of the tasks that are currently done manually in e-discovery, let alone information governance. And the risks are enormous. There's liability risks, there's governance risk, regulatory risk. Everybody knows the examples of the law firms that went bust because of these liability risks. So so I always ask law firms, okay, why are you afraid of technology? And is it because you don't understand it? Because I can explain it to you. If you don't trust it, I understand that, and I can create trust for you. But if you don't want to use technology, there's two reasons, actually, which are very hard to address. One is that if you have a criminal defense lawyer and most of their clients are guilty, they are absolutely not interested in factuality. They come up with some kind of story like, okay, the bank was robbed, but my client just happened to be there, and actually he wasn't part of the robbing gang, and yeah, then he was arrested. You know those types of stories. Criminal defense lawyers, they don't need AI most of the time, because they know AI will find the evidence against their clients. So the other part are lawyers that are more interested in billable hours than in providing efficiency and quality. You know, if that's your business model, you get away with it, your customers accept it, yeah, there's very little I can do against it. I can only show the way that provide more job security in the future.
Yeah.
And that's to embrace technology or work with it together.
Well, I mean, the thing that we find is that, we get new technologies, but we also, that also develops new types of work and that's been historical. So, that'll happen. Yeah. That'll, happen here too.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And we'll become prompt writers now. Yeah? And it's a new profession.
That's it.
Prompt writer for GPT.
It's a brand new career.
Yeah, our guest last week was talking about how he's hiring prompt engineers, which
it's like,
really,
yeah,
really
yeah.
It's no, yeah. How different is it than learning Boolean search? I mean, learning computer commands. It's the same sort of thing.
Well, I was in Reims in France last week, and I visited the Carnegie Library there, which was donated by Carnegie after the First World War. Reims was completely destructive in the First World War. And there was a reading room at the right, and in the left there were these old antique wooden cardbox drawers with all the index cards, and it was called the index room.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. Yeah, where did the librarians go? Yeah, but we have different. I absolutely agree with you. Yeah, but it's important to create the trust and the defensibility and the transparency. And this is also I don't know if you already interviewed Mara Grossman. But this is also what Morrow says, you should not accept black boxes. The worst thing we can do in the industry is to provide the industry with black boxes. That will never create trust.
Yeah.
So if a vendor and this proprietary technology and they're secretive about it, walk away from it.
Yeah.
There's the ethic. I mean, the black box and the ethical obligations just don't mix.
Yeah. Well, and under the GDPR, there's Article 22, which gives every citizen the right to explanation if an automatic system decides something about it. And very quickly, we're moving towards the Artificial Intelligence Act, where that's even a stronger right. So the right for explanation is a very important right that citizens have. So if you cannot explain your technology, you're in trouble. Because the AI Act is going to be going to have a much bigger impact even than the GDPR has on doing business in Europe.
Yeah. Well, Jan, one of the things that's getting a lot of press this week is Alan over in the UK, I believe, has launched Harvey AI, which is their supposed version of AI tool similar to ChatGPT that is, from the press accounts, is supposed to be open to some of their clients to test on there. We were joking before we jumped on that when you go to the website there, you get a logo, a little tagline, and then a link that says, you know, click here to get on the waiting list, and not much else. Here we call that, you know, fantastic marketing, because even though that's all that you see, there must be, you know, dozens of articles talking about how innovative A&O is on this. So, so I know we can't, you know, we don't have specifics of what they're doing, but let's go ahead and just talk about what we think they might be doing or what law firms see as a opportunity here to, I guess, impress their clients and allow them to kind of get that stickiness with the relationship.
Yeah, yeah. No, and this is also, I think, the way to go. Microsoft has created Copilot in GitHub, which you probably know. It's like, a program that helps you to assist you to write computer code. And they found that developers are like 40% faster writing code. You know, what Alan Overy did, and I have to be careful what I say, because I also went to the website from harvey.ai, and as I'm not a law firm, I cannot put myself on the waiting list. So I don't know. I've not seen the demo. I have to rely on the press release that was sent out. And I don't know whether, I heard rumors it's GPT-4, but then nobody knows what GPT-4 is about anyway. So is it a trillion or 100 trillion parameters? We don't know. We don't know what it's trained on. But I made a couple of interesting observations. And that also relates to what Bing did with the ChatGPT. I think, you know, these are really, really super interesting times. I've been in natural language processing for 30 years and it never worked. You know, and I even backtracked from NLP in 1985 to information retrieval because at least that worked. Then in 2017, Google, because all of this comes from Google, that's the really interesting part, and Microsoft kind of hijacked it. Google came with the famous paper, Attention is All You Need, introducing the transformers. And that was a radical improvement in quality for machine translation. We've all noticed how good Google Translate became, but also in understanding the search queries that are sent to the search engine. And Google Search also became much better. And what happened now is that there's a special form of these transformers that are decoder-only models. Normally, transformers are encoders and decoders. The encoders kind of control what the decoder does. But they figured out if you have a decoder model only, that also works great in certain cases. And that's what the GPT models are, generative pre-trained transformers. But this, as they say in MIT, they're just stochastic parrots. They repeat whatever they've seen, and the only thing they can do is predict whatever words coming after a couple of other words. But the really great achievement, there's three parts of that achievement, is first of all, we can now generate language with computers that can no longer be distinguished from human beings. That's something we never were able to do. We're also able to stay within ethical boundaries, more or less, unless you fool it or hack it. And we found a way, reinforcement learning, the same method also used in the AlphaGo experiments, the success that we can actually have the computer talk with other humans and then make sure it stays on track and the conversation is more engaging. Now, there's two parts missing in order to be successful. The first part is that the computer doesn't know what it's talking about. It doesn't understand the meaning of the text. So we need to have some kind of guidance to drive that. And the other part is missing. The models are now trained with data from the deep dark sides of the internet. So we need to do vertical training. We need to do training with all of, you know, casual contracts, or this is probably what Alan Overy did, all of their legal data, because that's their power in the future. It's all the contracts, all the documents they have, they can use to train these models. And if we call that vertical training. So if we do more vertical training and we can control what's being generated by understanding the meaning of text, so we move more from just, you know, statistical patterns to natural language understanding and natural language inference, then these models will become much better. And then the future, indeed, is to create co-pilots. But the co-pilots can never be trusted 100%. So you always need to have there, again, a human to validate what they did. Now, one of the things that I observe both in the Bing search engine and in this part is that the Bing search engine with ChatGPT doesn't have any vertical knowledge. And it starts doing really, really weird things after a couple of different prompts. So they limit it. You've probably also read that great story in the New York Times. Everybody's falling for the Eliza effect. And there's some other great articles also on The Verge written about it. And of course, The Wired, always the best articles. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the demo from Microsoft, you see that the queries are very specific, very detailed. I want to have this holiday and then this and then this and then this. Now, that's not how normally people search. We search with one keyword and we expect to get like the right answers based on one and maybe two keywords. And the average keyword we Google is 1.2. Now, the reason why these queries are so very specific is that otherwise it doesn't work. Now, you also, if you look at the examples from Harvey, okay, here we go. This is one of them. I copied it this morning. I'm at a German law firm and going to present to an Indian bank about the European Union market abuse regime. Suggest a skeleton in a 5-slide presentation, and for each slide include 3 bullet points on its content. That's highly detailed. Yeah. And then for these models, it's possible to split this up the number of prompts and use that to generate the data. If you have less specific and less detailed questions or problems, you will see that humans will probably understand what you're talking about. And they know your culture, your background, they know you as a client, so they can much faster than generate a proper document. And these examples are all extremely, I think I'm a little bit artificial. It's very good we're doing this. It's very good we're doing experiments. I understood that also Sullivan and Quinn Emanuel and Urbart are using this. And if I were a law firm, I would absolutely also look at this. Because this is what you want to do. You want to have a co-pilot for drafting contracts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so speaking of the future, we've reached the part in the podcast, Jan, where we ask the crystal ball question. And so we ask you, what do you see as the significant challenge or changes on the horizon for the legal industry over the next 2 to 5 years?
Yeah, well, I think everybody woke up in the legal industry in the last 2 months. So that's really helpful. The part where we have to be very careful as an industry is the explainable AI. We should address that. Otherwise, we will never have trust. I also think that right now, lawyers shouldn't be too worried. But the moment there are vertically trained models, and they will be there, I'm very confident there's now probably 50 or 100 startups building co-pilots for specific legal applications. Maybe antitrust, maybe HR, maybe contract or whatever. And once those models are out, and that will be a major change in the industry. And that's going to happen. I also think that what Microsoft did with integrating Bing ChatGPT is a very, very interesting experiment. But there's one part is missing. What's missing is that Bing is just finding web pages and it's forwarding those web pages unfiltered, unstructured into ChatGPT. And that doesn't work. And we need to understand the meaning of these words. We need to understand the meaning of the relation of these words, the semantics, and not just the word sequences. And then you'll see that these models will become much better. Now, all of that's going to happen, not only in the legal industry, also in the medical industry. Also, I would be really worried if I were a content writer, a communication expert, because that industry will probably change first. If you are in telemarketing, if you are in any other creative profession, there will be a lot of changes, but then there's also a lot of legal risks. There's a lot of uncertainty now that we have. Copyright risks, liability risks, But for me, as an AI researcher, these are the most interesting times of my life. And like I said, it finally works. You know, now we have to make sure that we can create the trust that's needed so society will embrace what we develop.
Yeah. All right. Well, Jan Schultz, we want to thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us today. This has been fun. And man, we're right at the beginning of this.
That's right.
Yeah.
And of course, thanks to all of you, our audience, for taking the time to listen to the Geek in Review podcast. If you enjoy the show, share it with a colleague. We'd love to hear from you, so reach out to us on social media. I can be found at GabeBauerM on Twitter.
And I can be reached at Glambert on Twitter. Jan, what's the best way for people to reach out to you?
LinkedIn, Jan Schultz for my name, Jan Schultes or Johannes Schultes, and you find me, more than willing to engage with you.
Perfect. And we'll, of course, have all the connectors on the page when we post. But if, you know, you're old school and you don't want to do any of that, you can leave us a voicemail on our Geek & Review hotline at 713-487-7821. And as always, the music you hear is from Jerry David DeSica. Thank you, Jerry.
Thanks, Jerry. All right, Marlene, I'll talk to you later.
Okay, bye-bye.